Good afternoon. Welcome to Division One of the Colorado Court of Appeals. We have two cases set at 1:30 and then an additional case at 2:30. Our counsel present and ready on the case of where's my cases? There we go. Okay. Counsel present and ready on 2009 CA-220 People versus Nance. Okay. And I see you're already set up. And our counsel present and ready on Brown versus Heimbecker, 2009 CA-178.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. I see that our two counsel arguing on behalf of the appellees. And have you decided how you will divide your time?
We have.
And would you like me to remind you at the division point, or are you going to take care of that yourselves?
I'll be arguing first. I intend to use approximately 10 minutes of the time, Your Honor. If I can cut it off at that point, I'll do so.
Okay, I'll try to give you a little reminder if it looks like you're going beyond that.
Get the yellow light.
I believe that you've received a printed set of instructions about the court's procedures, and does anyone have any questions about those? I'd just like to remind you to identify yourselves by name and attorney number when you start your arguments. And if there's anyone who has a telephone or a pager in the courtroom, if you could please turn that off so as not to disrupt arguments. With that, we'll proceed with the first argument. You may begin.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is David Jones, registration number 23246. I represent the appellant, the people of the state of Colorado. The case before the court today is a criminal case wherein the defendant received the benefit of an exception to the two felony rule and was given probation. However, while on that probation, he left the state, failed to maintain contact, and within 4 months, he was before the court again on a violation of probation. The trial court accepted an admission to the violation of probation, and the terms of that plea agreement were open to the court. The court, in its sentencing, revoked the defendant's probation and resentenced pursuant to 1611-206 sub 5. When it resentenced, it re-granted probation and found that the two felony rule, which the people argue apply to the defendant and it continued to apply to the defendant when he was resentenced, court found that that no longer applied as the original sentence relieved the defendant of the two felony rule responsibilities.
I have a question about the probation revocation procedure. When a court does a resentencing, as it's called, after probation revocation, is the defendant required to submit a written application for probation as he would under 18.1.3201?
Your Honor, I considered that, and I tried to make some phone calls. I can tell the court that I don't know. I can also tell the court that I have yet to see a written application for the original sentence. It's not in the court's file, and to my knowledge, it's not in probation's file. So as far as Arapahoe County, where this case is located, I don't even know if they comply with the statute in regard to the actual written application as required by that statute.
But is it your position then that the written application that's referred to in 1.3201 would be required after a probation revocation proceeding?
It is my position that an application is required, yes. Whether it's written, like I say, it seems to be de facto a situation of the court is not requiring a written application. But it's my position that a written application upon any sentencing is necessary.
Is it your position that the trial court was barred from resentencing him to probation in the absence of an application?
It is my position that when the defendant, when the court, the trial court, revoked his probation, as opposed to continuing his probation, it set into motion the two felony rule.
No, that was a different question than I asked you. I asked you whether or not you thought that the trial court was barred from imposing probation simply because there was no application made.
No, it is not my position that is the circumstance. What we're faced with today is in trying to determine the meaning and the intent of the legislature in enacting the two felony rule and its exception pursuant to sub 4. And in making this determination, We know we look at the plain language of the statute, and we know we look at the whole statute to give consistency and harmonious effect to what was intended by the legislature. And the court also knows that it is important that the court avoid illogical results or absurd results. The language of 18.1.3201(2) and sub 4A, neither one of them addressed the issue of the scope of the exception to the two felony rule. But the people maintain that when you look at those two sections and consider the entire probation scheme that was outlined in 1973 by the legislature. Now, granted, there have been some changes to that scheme over the course of the years, but at that time, the two felony rule was in effect then, as it is now. And it was only until 1990 that the exception to the two felony rule was enacted. The purpose of the two felony rule is to restrict the trial court. The legislature has determined that when you have two prior felonies, you're being sentenced on a third, probation is no longer appropriate. But it considered the exceptions, those unusual exceptions, and enacted that exception statute, subsection 4. It is a rare event when that occurs. It is a last opportunity when that occurs. And it is illogical to believe that the legislature would set up a system where a check and balance is established at the original plea, that check and balance being a member of the executive branch must recommend and a member of the judiciary must approve probation when there's two prior felonies. It is illogical to believe that they would set up that check and balance system for the original sentence and not intend that that remain in effect when an individual's resentenced on probation, when they violated the terms and conditions of that probation.
Mr. Jones, why is that illogical?
Because the person who is given that opportunity on probation after having experienced two prior felonies is in a worse position after having violated probation than they would have been at the original sentencing.
But isn't it true that the trial court judge in that situation can still sentence the defendant to a term of incarceration?
Yes. It is true that at the original sentence, the court can reject the two felony recommend the exception to the two felony rule as recommended by the district attorney and still incarcerate.
It would be true after the finding of a probation revocation based upon what the trial court judge did here.
Yes, the court can revoke probation and resentence. Now, that brings into effect the provisions of 1611-206 sub 5, which says the court has options. It isn't restricted to revoking probation. It's got two options. One of those options is to continue probation. The other option is to revoke and resentence, pursuant to Part 2, which makes reference to this very rule, the two felony rule. So when 1611-206 sub 5 makes reference to resentencing pursuant to this part, it's referencing this very statute. If the court wished to regrant probation, and this happens quite a bit, where there's a revocation and a regranting, the court has to comply with those two options. It can either, one, when there's a two felony rule situation, it can, one, continue probation without correcting any problems it might see in that probationary sentence. And that's pursuant to Gallagher. It's a circumstance where the court must evaluate whether the original sentence was appropriate, whether the original probationary sentence is going to affect rehabilitation. And if it believes that a continued probationary sentence will, it must continue that probationary sentence without modification. The revoke and regrant changes the conditions of probation. At the very minimum, what happens is that the length of probation is extended. The court may just do, unlike this court did, may just do a revoke, regrant, 5 years probation starting that the day of sentencing, which is uncommon, but it does occur. I have yet to see a court revoke, regrant, and reduce probation to accommodate the time already served. That's a continuance as opposed to a revocation. And those two must be separated.
Mr. Jones, as I understand it, though, on resentencing here, the judge also imposed a 90-day jail sentence.
That's right. He resentenced and imposed additional conditions, a 90-day jail sentence, and a condition that before he's released, he must have a stable living environment. He changed the conditions of probation. So he did not continue probation. He revoked and resentenced. But that's where the problem arises. When he revoked and resentenced, he was then subject to the two-felony rule. And by not applying the two-felony rule, that's where he went afoul.
Let me ask you a question. Did the defendant in this case admit to the probation violation?
He did.
Should he have been advised then a consequence of his admitting to the probation violation would be that he would not be eligible for a regrant of probation absent the consent of the district attorney's office?
He should have been advised by his attorney.
No. Should he have been advised by the trial court?
It's not necessary under...
As a direct consequence of your plea?
Under Rule 11, I don't believe it is required because he is advised of the possible penalties of his plea. And much like a circumstance where a court is sentences an individual to, say, 7 years on a 10-year sentence, and there's the additional 3 years parole, it doesn't matter whether they were notified that there was this 3 years parole, as long as they were notified that there was that exposure to 10 years within the system. So it's very similar in that context. If he's advised of the possible penalties, the maximum possible penalties, he has received a full advisement.
Well, has he received a full advisement? Because when he's stepping up to admit to his probation violation, under your theory, he's automatically going to prison unless the district attorney waives the two-felony rule.
He's automatically going to a corrections facility. He could be sentenced to community corrections. He could be sentenced to the Department of Corrections. But he is no longer eligible for a probation pursuant to the two-felony rule. I can tell the court that I also have never experienced a situation where an individual is advised prior to his plea when he is exposed to the two-felony rule situation of the consequences of the two-felony rule. And I have not seen a case that addresses that issue. If there are any further questions, I'll reserve my remaining time.
Thank you, counsel. You have just under 4 minutes.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Pam Dayton, attorney registration number 19735, on behalf of Mr. Nance. The state's argument depends on a premise that I think is incorrect, which is that the two prior felony rule or the waiver of the two prior, or the recommendation of the waiver of the two prior felony rule operates in the same way that a sentencing cap or a sentence stipulation operates. I argued this in my answer brief, but I just wanted to elaborate a little bit because I think if you look at it and compare it to a reduction in charge or the dismissal of habitual offender counts or the outright dismissal of charges, you can see that the recommendation by the DA operates in the same way, in that it is a condition precedent to the court's ability to impose a sentence, in these cases, a lower sentence than it would otherwise be able to impose. Just as a reduced charge is not inflated when a defendant violates probation or dismissed counts or not resurrected, the recommendation of the waiver of the two prior felony rule is not negated by a violation of probation. The state's argument also depends on the difference between a court saying probation is revoked and reinstated, or the court saying, I'm going to continue you on probation. We don't know yet what this court is going to decide, obviously, and there are no cases on this point at present. The court here was presented with this situation and obviously believed that the law was that the waiver was not negated by the defendant's admission to the probation violation. The court said a number of times in its discussion at the sentencing hearing, I believe four different times, that the court contemplated in this case continuing the probation or reinstating the probation, adding certain conditions. And the court's intent was absolutely clear what it intended to do. The state didn't raise the issue of its refusal or its inclination not to recommend waiver of the two-part felony rule until after Mr. Nance had admitted the probation violation. The court is correct that Mr. Nance was not advised that the probation would not be a possibility. The original plea agreement doesn't indicate any limitation on the original recommendation, and the plea agreement, such as it was for the probation violation, contained no language at all about the district attorney's recommendation of a waiver.
Ms. Staten, I'd like to ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Jones. At the conclusion of a probation revocation or at the start of the proceeding, does the defendant have to apply for probation in the same sense that he would under 1.3201?
No. No. And in this case, in answer to the question that preceded that, there was no written application made for probation because there was a stipulation to probation and all parties agreed to go to immediate sentencing. So I've never seen any language in the statute that requires reapplication, and in practice, as a trial lawyer, I've never seen that be the case.
Okay, I guess the reason why I'm asking about it is not so much a practical matter, but I'm looking at the statute that includes the section in which the DA has to make a recommendation for a waiver of the two prior felony rule. And the structure of that statute seems to apply to the initial application for probation.
Right. That's the threshold for eligibility. So once the district attorney makes a recommendation and then the court waives the application of the rule, then the defendant is eligible for probation. And as the trial court found in this case, once there's a legal probation sentence, all of the usual terms of the statute regarding probation violation apply.
Well, Ms. Dane, if that's so, then what do we do about the language in McDaniels that Mr. Jones didn't mention to us in his argument, but he did in his brief, that under 1611-206-5, that when a plea is probation has been revoked, the court considers the statutory limits of the sentence unaffected by any plea bargain?
Well, this goes back to my earlier point that argument depends on the equation of the district attorney's recommendation of the waiver with sentencing caps and sentence stipulations.
So what's the difference?
The difference is that a sentence cap, a sentence stipulation, is a component of the plea bargain that goes into effect after the plea, and it places a limit on the court's initial discretion to impose sentence. The difference with the recommendation of the waiver is that it is a condition precedent that allows the stipulation to probation, the sentence cap, and the the other sentence conditions to be affected. So the district attorney's recommendation is just like the reduction of charge, for example. That occurs prior to the defendant's submission of his guilty plea, and it permits the court to sentence the defendant to a lower sentence, right? If the charge is originally an F3, he's exposed to a greater sentence. Once the district attorney reduces the charge, he's exposed to a lesser sentence. When a defendant violates probation, that charge is not reinflated to the Class 3 felony. So in the same way, the recommendation that the two prior felony rule be waived, that allows the court a greater discretion in sentencing, and it permits particularly the defendant to be sentenced to a lower sentence than, you know, than otherwise would be the case.
So is there anything in the overall statutory scheme that supports your interpretation, given that I think everybody's agreed that the plain language of the statute doesn't tell us the answer to the issue we're addressing this afternoon?
Well, I think, I guess the way I would answer that is that, you know, McDaniels is very specific. And no, obviously the statute doesn't address it, but McDaniels is very specific that it concerns sentence caps, sentence stipulations, and the rationale for allowing the court to ignore the original sentence cap or to say that the original sentence cap no longer applies is that there's a different, the language is something, a different factual predicate, you know, for sentencing, and the defendant already got the benefit of the sentence cap. But it's the nature of the thing that's different. I really don't, I guess I don't really know how to articulate that better. I mean, the district attorney's recommendation is not the waiver and it is not the stipulation. It's a separate thing. It's a thing that must occur in order for those other things to be enacted.
I suppose it would be unusual, but a recommendation could occur outside the context of a plea bargain, couldn't it?
Sure. Sure, absolutely.
Is there any room in your interpretation of the statute for a reservation of rights recommendation, whereas the DA explicitly sets forth and said, we waive this, the two felony rule, or we recommend waiver of the two felony rule, but only for purposes of initial sentencing?
Oh, sure. They could put that in the plea agreement if they chose to. They didn't in this case.
If they did, they could then come back on resentencing and say, we have the right to assert the two felony rule?
I think so. I mean, if it's in the plea agreement, the defendant is advised, he knows full well when he comes back in on a probation violation that he's going to be exposed to that whole problem again. In this case, that didn't happen. So Mr. Nance was never advised that this waiver was limited. And that's the other problem, which I discuss in my brief, but there's nothing in the original plea agreement and there's nothing in the language of the statute that limits the waiver. Once it occurs, there's nothing that informs or provides notice to a defendant that it's limited in any way. Any other questions? I'll just take a minute. In this case, I think one very important thing is that the court, if this court's going to decide that the difference between whether or not the court can impose probation here or not depends on whether or not the court revoked probation and is resentencing, which is what the state is arguing, then I think this case has to be remanded to the trial court for to give the trial court an opportunity to articulate its ruling in accord with its intent. Because here, the court was operating under the mistaken belief, if this is the way this court comes out, that the waiver it continues, and that the court was had discretion to resentence Mr. Nance to probation. I mean, here the court said that it intended to continue Mr. Nance on probation and impose some additional conditions, jail and a stable living environment. The court didn't use the revoke and reinstate language until it made its final order. So if this court decides this case in the way that the state is suggesting, I think it's necessary for the trial court to have the opportunity to re-articulate its order.
So are you suggesting that along the lines of People v. Guadney that we should vacate the sentence, or is it if we were to agree with Mr. Jones' position that we could or should vacate the sentence and allow the court to reconsider continuing the original sentence without a revocation of probation?
Yes. Yes, and I think especially under the conditions here where the prosecutor didn't mention the that the two prior felony rule problem or that it was going to take a different position after probation violation than it did, you know, prior to, and all parties were surprised by this, and Mr. Nance had already admitted the probation violation and the court had already, you know, heard some of the sentencing argument, and then the prosecutor said, well, we're not waiving the two prior felony rule. I think under those circumstances, it's only fair that the court be allowed to do that. Thank you.
There were two issues that were brought up that I wanted to address. The first is the idea that the recommendation under 18.1.3201 sub 4 is different than a plea bargain. A plea bargain is nothing more than a recommendation. A waiver of the two felony rule is nothing more than a recommendation. And when the parties have indicated that that is a condition of their plea bargain, any one of those, if rejected by the court, would cause a situation of the court having to let the parties withdraw from the plea.
Yeah. Counsel, let's just imagine that a defendant is going to the court for sentencing without a plea bargain, unnegotiated, and the court realizes that he's got the two prior felonies and looks over at the prosecutor and says, are you willing to waive the two prior felony rule? And the good-hearted prosecutor, based on the merits of the case, says, yes, we'll do that. And that would be a recommendation outside of a plea bargain context, correct?
It is. The phrases used in McDaniels aren't limited by the plea agreement necessarily. For example, McDaniel says once probation is revoked, a different factual predicate exists upon which the sentence is to be imposed. Important language, broad language, language that would encompass the very issue you bring up. Additionally, the probation sentence, when a probationary sentence is revoked, is vacated. It's gone. It's revoked. And the court stands in the position of resentencing. There is no probationary sentence still active. So the recommendation that goes back to the original sentence is also gone. That entire plea is gone, bringing us back to McDaniel's language, which talks about the court stands in the same position it would have been if it was sentencing pursuant to the statutes.
Mr. Jones, it seems to me that the entire plea agreement isn't gone because here one of the conditions of the plea agreement was that the assault charges against Mr. Nance were dismissed and he pleaded guilty to a menacing charge.
I grant you that. And I think McDaniels recognized that as well. I'm not saying that it negates the substantive aspects of the charges that were changed. The charges that are changed are actually at the discretion of the district attorney. The DA maintains the discretion to dismiss charges. The court maintains the discretion to accept conditions of a plea bargain as far as sentencing is concerned. That's what distinguishes those circumstances. So the court, if the DA is saying, we're moving to dismiss, is not in a position to say, I'm not going to dismiss, whereas it can say, I'm not accepting the sentence stipulations that you are proposing to me, which is similar to the circumstance of the recommendation of the two felony rule issue.
But when the court in McDaniels talks about going back to the original situation unaffected by any plea bargain, it really could not have been contemplating a situation where you'd wipe out a charge that was dismissed and go back to the original charge. I assume you would agree with that.
I would, and that's what I was trying to articulate, apparently not
right,
very well.
Okay. No, I that's what I thought that you were expressing.
But so. What it does do is it takes away those sentence stipulations that were agreed to, every one of them. There's not one that is left that is not subject to resentencing. They're off the table at that point, subject to the court resentencing, but when there's a two felony rule situation, the court's hands are tied when it's resentencing and that circumstance is present, that being that the two felony rule is still applicable.
Counsel, I see your red light is on. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.